All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter Podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter.
Megan, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm good. How's life?
Better at just starting this thing without a big announcement, without a welcome to the there.
Okay, but we have a big announcement because we have a special guest with us for the intro today.
Woo! Who is it?
It's
Kevin.
<me.
laughs> Kevin Nye. Kevin Nye, everybody from Twitter. Say hello, Kevin.
Kevin Nye, who apparently needs no introduction.
No introduction. I feel like we have been talking about having you do an intro with us because you are like Twitter goals for, I mean, both of us to some extent. Like, it's, you're one of those people that I'm like, man, fuck, I wish I would have tweeted that thing. And so, like, talking about Twitter, we've been wanting to have you a part of this.
Oh, so. Man, that makes me happy because... It takes up so much of my time and energy, but I started because, you know, I was writing a book and everyone was like, you got to have a platform. So I got on Twitter because that's the only social media that makes any sense to me and just dove in completely. And, I've put up some boundaries around it and I've gotten a little better than I was at first, but it's quite a, It's time consuming. I love it. It's addicting, and all of a sudden you've lost a good portion of your day.
It's so much more, and I think it's the reason I didn't like it at first, because I didn't have any like actual, I didn't get into Twitter. I've had one since like forever, but I didn't really regularly use it until I met Megan, really. And then I was like, ooh, this is a person that I actually have who I can interact with. And her and I were interacting, and then obviously she has like a bunch of people that she interacts with on Twitter.
Okay, but the secret about my Twitter is I would not be who I am on Twitter without Kevin Nye, because I was interacting with people behind a logo. It said The Pursuing Life. I had a logo, and Kevin and I were running a Facebook group for progressive Christian writers together. And he very kindly and very gently reached out and was like, I don't know if you want to know this or if you are open to thoughts, but I think perhaps if you were like a name and a picture, people would interact with you more. And it changed my Twitter everything.
Yeah. This is like very early on in our friendship too. And I was like, I don't know if we're at a point where I can give
this is advice. Crossing a line. Is like, there a boundary?
I think I even like set it up like with eight texts ahead of time. Like, so would you be interested in hearing advice if I happen to have any?
And down really the line, like in a few DMs.
And it wasn't a text, it was Facebook Messenger, because we had not reached that level of friendship.
Started texted yet.
So,
well, it totally is true. Like, we've talked about the new evangelicals before on Twitbits, and I have no idea what that guy's name is. And he's in my feed all the time.
Yeah.
You know his name, right? Is it
Tim?
Yeah, Tim. But now I kind of know what his face looks like because he pops up in the videos and Instagram. But yeah, I just saw that as a logo for a long time. Yeah. And
it does make a difference, I think.
Specifically really on Twitter too. Like, you on Instagram, you know, you can get a little more with pages, and same with Facebook, you can be a little less personal in kind of those different spaces. But something about Twitter just feels extremely personal.
Yeah. But The Pursuing Life is a memorable name though. And I like that you have that, because I think it is, distinguishes you in a way and is memorable from like any other Megan you may be talking about.
Except for the fact that I just found out that some church has a Pursuing Life podcast, and it's not, it's the Pursuing Life, and it comes up right under me on the search on Google. Really? And I was like,
I know you told me that, but I didn't Google it. So I didn't see, is the podcast any good? Do you think they'll have us on?
That's the OG Pursuing Life. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't think I'm their vibe.
Should we send them a cease and desist letter?
Maybe. Hey, I don't know.
As long as it comes up after you in a Google search, you're doing fine.
Okay, yeah. There you go. Well, and I'm afraid to click. The more you Google it, the more it's going to come up, right? So it's like, don't click on it.
Okay. All right, deal. I won't click on it. Let's get into it. Twitbits. There's Twitter things to talk about. And Megan, you had a little plan. Or somewhat of a plan.
I think we probably ought to talk about Dave Ramsey. We've got both of you talked a little bit about Dave Ramsey. I don't know, Kevin, do you want to give a little bit of a... I know it all kind of started with the video, the interview that he gave, and I watched it, but I don't know, Kevin, do you want to give a sum up of it?
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing an interview and somebody asked him about sort of the ethics around owning rental properties, and whether it was ethical or Christian to raise the rent on tenants in a way that could actually kick tenants out. And he gave a pretty defensive answer. You could tell he was kind of like on his heels and spiraling a little bit.
He hasn't faced any drama or like backlash at all, like ever, right? I can't imagine why he would be defensive.
He gets a lot of criticism, but I've never seen it done to his face quite like this. And maybe that's part of what kind of caught him on his heels. But he just kind of was saying that, you know, that it's not unethical if the market determines that the value of the property is worth more, then you're completely within your rights to evict people, raise the rent, sort of talking about the market as if it's this completely neutral force that we owe our allegiance to and that has no ethical ramifications at all. There's been a lot of discourse about it.
I actually hadn't even seen that video. I had just seen a reply. Somebody replied to his tweet, which didn't have to do with rental properties. It was something about success. He had said something about like, I don't know, it's like basically if you want success, then you get it. And if you don't have it, it's because you don't want it. Or I don't know, it was something else offensive.
Yeah. Well, he has a new book that either just came out or it's about to come out that's basically 7 easy steps to become a millionaire. And it's says anyone can become a millionaire if they have the discipline to follow these 7 steps. I don't know what they are because I'm not touching that book with a 10-foot pole, but I'm sure they're not equally accessible to all people.
And it's pretty tone deaf for the time that we're in right now too. It's like, you know, here we're at a time where there's been so many people that are having a pause from paying rent and all of, you know, and there's people that are having assistance and all kinds of things and unemployment. And so for him to come out and just be like, hey, and by the way, this is the way to success and this is the path. But it's funny because I just got blocked by him. I wasn't even involved in the conversation, but
I'm so annoyed by that, by the way, because I'm not. And I literally have a viral tweet right now criticizing him. And this always happens to me. Like the same thing with Sean Foyt. I like rallied the entire city of Los Angeles against him and he won't block me. Like, what do I have to do? And then like,
I think I retweeted your tweet, Kevin. I think that's,
I know other people say like nothing and they're like block.
I always wonder how the decisions are made. I mean, Mark Driscoll is a classic, just like over blocker. Like you barely have to interact. And some people who haven't even interacted at all. And I wonder like what I'm sure it's teams of people. It's like an intern or like various people who manage these people's accounts who do this. For you know these platformed people, but I do always wonder the logic and like whether there's something like to the algorithm or to like an actual social strategy that would say like a critic that's not going to boost your profile is worth blocking because you can minimize that person's voice or cut down on the criticism, but somebody who maybe their criticism gives more platform, you like maybe there's some like social media strategy that says that you wouldn't want to block that person because it may like affect your algorithmic reach or something. I'm curious if it's like motivated by wanting bigger platform.
I think there's got to be a bot, know. Like a blocking, because I know when Abraham Piper, everybody kind of figured out that he was on Twitter and using Twitter. A lot of people were like, wait a second, I'm blocked. I've never even interacted. Who is Abraham Piper? And he tweeted about it and said, I have some words that I block, or he said something. It might even be his pinned tweet, but it explained like there's a rhyme and a reason and there's names that I've blocked. And for him, it seemed like there was a boundary issue there, which I would completely understand.
If you like ever retweeted his dad, like you're automatically blocked.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Unironically. Like, you know, I don't set out to get blocked by these people. I know some people do that, and no judgment there. That's just not how I want to conduct myself on Twitter. I think part of it too is that I don't usually tag them, unless I am trying to talk to them or it's something that I want them to see to like engage in dialogue or experience some kind of pushback on something. But rarely that's the case. And I didn't tag Dave Ramsey, which might be why I didn't get blocked.
Yeah. Tell us about your viral tweet. What did you say?
Yeah. Should I pull it up or just summarize it?
Either way.
Yeah. Well, I guess, so I do a lot of thinking about the prosperity gospel because of my work around homelessness. And I tend to think that a lot of the way that we treat homelessness and poverty is just the inversion of the prosperity gospel. So the prosperity gospel says, if you follow God in this way, you'll get rich. The flip side of that is if you're poor, it's because you're not following God properly, or you don't love God enough, or you aren't trying hard enough. And I think that's the side that we don't talk about as much that really affects my work. And so when I see Dave Ramsey doing what he's doing, what you just described, Cortland, around if you're successful, you can be successful as long as you want to. And if you're not, it's because you just don't want to.
You're not trying. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when he coupled that talking about rental properties and knowing that, you know, obviously housing is so deeply connected to homelessness, I was like, I got to say something about this. So I kind of made that connection with it being the underbelly of the prosperity gospel, and that Dave Ramsey ultimately is grifting everybody and selling you the belief that if you follow his steps, that you'll be closer to God financially, even though those steps aren't equally attainable for everyone. And then pointing out too that his system sort of needs poor people to exist, which is why he has no problem evicting people or raising rent on people, because if there isn't the threat or the fear of becoming poor, then nobody's going to buy his stuff, right? You sort of need that underclass to stoke the fear so that you'll want to not be like them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I'm curious what your perspective, because I hadn't actually even seen your tweet till Megan brought it up to me. I had seen a reply to this tweet that Dave Ramsey had done, or somebody quote tweeted, and then talking about, you know, some replies to that were talking about property and rentals. And so then I tweeted out, because I'm just genuinely curious, I basically just said, like, what would the economic impact of trying to transition? And I think I said all, but really what I would say in place of that, if I could edit my tweet, which we can't, but would be like, what if we
could pay for that for enough money, you could edit your tweets
within a few seconds of sending it, which is never when I see a mistake.
Yeah.
It's always like hours later. But I said, what if we tried to transition more renters into owners? Like, what if, like, our goal societally was to get more people who are renting their residence to buy residence? Like, what if we transfer ownership? Like, even if it's apartments or condos or whatever, like, ownership to me feels like a better thing than renting. Like, if you know, we had more people who could own and build equity in their residence, even, like I said, if it's a condo or apartment, what would be the economic impact of doing that versus just having people make more and more wealth off of rental properties? And not to say, and it was funny because I posted on Facebook and my landlord, who's a friend of mine who rents me the home I live in, was like, "Hey, motherfucker, just at me next time." Like, and I was like, "Oh, I'm this is not about, you're a great landlord." And like, she's actually working to try to get us to be able to buy the property we're renting. So she's the opposite of my question. But do you feel like there is, you know, your experience, Kevin, is more in the human side of housing, not in the economic side. But do you think that this mindset that's like, I mean, basically I've been told my whole life through Rich Dad, Poor Dad and every other, you know, self-help money-making book that buying property, owning property, and then using that property to make money is the kind of universally accepted way to become a millionaire, to make money, to build big chunks of wealth. And do you think that that's an aspect, that culture, that value is an aspect of why we have housing crisis an issue? Or do you think that the economics are unconnected?
Oh, they're absolutely connected. And what's interesting is historically, we have throughout our history invested in home ownership for white people specifically. You know, in the New Deal, you know, post-World War II, the GI Bill, we have historically offered white people countless opportunities for, you know, low percentage loans, no money down opportunities to get into their first home. And then, like you said, homes build equity. They stay in your family so that you're talking generational wealth. You're talking the increase of property value exponentially since that time. And that's very widely why we see, you know, the racial wealth gap, is because most wealth is in property and property has historically excluded people of color. So 100% they're related. And this idea that we should use owned property to generate wealth is very largely racial. You see primarily white people generating wealth by having renters who are people of color, and that just continues to accentuate that wealth gap. And that's why we see Black people especially very overrepresented in homelessness. It's not the only reason, but it's a primary reason. So, I mean, absolutely, they're fundamentally connected. I think that similar to the ways that we talk about the healthcare system and how screwed up that is because it's a for-profit system, I think housing is the same way.
Do you think, through your perspective of doing the work that you've been doing, addressing the specific, I mean, I think the specific argument that you kind of presented as Dave Ramsey's characterization of this issue, being that, like, well, we obviously do need rentals, right? There's like, I just had drinks, a happy hour drinks with a guy who just moved here and is in a short-term rental in Denver here before he's moving his family somewhere else, right? And he's needing to work here to do his training. He can't buy a home here. He's here for 6 months, right? So we need short-term rentals. Like, we need
in the military too. You got, yeah. I mean, yeah.
A lot of jobs cause people to have to move around. I mean, there is a necessity in our economics for rental properties. Mm-hmm. And I think what people like Dave Ramsey say is like, well, if you don't motivate people by wealth, how is anyone going to want to buy and rent and manage property if I'm not going to become a millionaire, right? Like, why are people going to want to, people say the same thing about healthcare, right? Like, if you make healthcare more affordable, you know, the reason that people go to medical school and spend all this time and work so hard is so that they can buy a Maserati, right? So that they can, right? Like, we motivate people societally and culturally by saying, why else would you want to be a doctor if you can go and be a trash man and make, you know, a decent living, and I'm going to go and be a doctor and make not that much more money or not be wealthy or a millionaire. How do we think about rental properties, property ownership, healthcare without motivating by people by this means that Dave Ramsey is that saying, hey, you could be unimaginably wealthy if you work hard.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but I guess fundamentally, I would just say we should not hold things hostage that are fundamentally required for humans to live. So, healthcare, housing, these are not things that people should be making millions off of, right? And we do need rentals, of course, but we need rentals in the way that we had them 100 years ago. But if you look at data right now of how many, you know, millennials, and, you know, millennials extend into their 40s are still renters, right? Like, this is not what we mean by we need rentals. it's just there is this idea of like, yeah, we need these things, but if you actually look at, you know, how we're utilizing them, it's just bonkers.
Yeah. Megan, do we have other things we want to talk about in the Twitter sphere?
Yeah. So
before we jump into the interview for today, because we're interviewing Kevin too. Teaser, spoiler alert.
Yeah, Kevin's coming up on an upcoming episode. So,
just our intro.
Yeah, as you soak in the wisdom from Kevin, just know that in a few weeks you'll have an even lengthier discussion to listen to. But
yeah, and if you're hearing this and you're saying, wow, this guy sucks, then you know which episode to skip.
Exactly. No. Is that plan accordingly?
Actually, I want to do a throwback to it, but because we have Kevin here, because a few weeks ago, I think it was just before Christmas, maybe, because I feel like I was in Chicago when this was happening. Kevin, you threw out some idea to have a karaoke bar with 90s and 2000s CCM music, and it just went viral. Like, everyone just came out of the woodwork to say, yes, this is something insane that needs to happen.
The nostalgia was just like real. Like, it was so, as people started replying to that tweet, I got so nostalgic reading.
I mean, I had Sandy Patty lyrics in my brain after that. I mean, I blame you for that. So I don't, Kevin, that spiraled into something else. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was so funny. I just kind of threw that tweet out there. I feel like I threw it out on like a Friday night too, which is historically not like a big Twitter night. Like the very few people that are just extremely lonely and have nothing to do are on there. So you're just tweeting for them. And I threw out there this funny idea of opening that karaoke bar just for CCM. And then I think I put, you know, what song are you singing first? And yeah, it blew up, and it just got to the point where so many people were commenting, and so many people were saying like, I would actually go to this. Like, can we do this? And a couple people who I've been connected to for a while were messaging me and being like, is this a thing that we could do like virtually? And yeah, that just kind of got the gears turning, and it was just so popular. I was like, I think we have to do this. And so we've been planning a Zoom karaoke night for specifically contemporary Christian music for post-evangelicals, sort of an opportunity to what I've been saying is like unironically belt out these songs, and not unironically in the sense that we're pretending like these songs are okay or that the lyrics aren't sometimes really problematic, but like just for the singing of them, we can pretend like we're in our car and nobody is judging us and we're not thinking about the lyrics. We're just unlocking those core memories and living our previous evangelical dream. And maybe we're like laughing at some of those songs and getting power over them in a way they had power over us. maybe some of them like were reclaiming because the lyrics are actually like not all that bad. You know, I don't want to determine what's going to happen, but I want everyone to like feel comfortable despite us all having in some way kind of moved on from that phase of our lives to like just enjoy that blissful memory or even painful memory in a new way. Yeah.
And somehow you wrote me into co-hosting with you, which I made it very clear. I do not sing.
That you're singing the first song.
I do not sing. I can help facilitate, but
Megan said, I'll only come if I can open and close the night.
With awesome God. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
No, but spoiler alert, we might have a couple guests that that people might recognize from the CCM world that night. So we have a date, right? What's the date?
Yeah. Yes. February 4th, which is a Friday night at 7:30 Pacific time. So it's going to be a little later for the East Coast folks. But yeah, pretty soon I'm going to start advertising it probably around the time that this episode will air. So yeah, go find me on Twitter and there'll be a way to RSVP to indicate whether you're wanting to sing or just hang out. You don't have to sing to come. You can just watch. And it's actually, I'm utilizing it as a fundraiser for an organization that I've been consulting with who does karaoke on Skid Row. So it's a perfect kind of crossover for the importance of togetherness and the fun of singing together is something that all humans enjoy. So we want to try to support those who are doing it for the most vulnerable in Skid Row, Los Angeles. So yeah, you should come.
Yeah. And you don't have to sing either. I'm going to sing, but we would love to hear you sing, but I'm not going to be singing. We'll put the info in the show notes.
This episode comes out tomorrow. So we'll have it in the show notes of Bradley Onishi's episode, which is what we're doing the intro for. And we're like right at time to probably get into that at this point. Right?
Yeah. No, I'm stoked to have everybody listen to Bradley Onishi. It was exciting to sit down with him. And yeah, it's a great interview.
Dude, Brad is like a podcasting hero. Straight White American Jesus is like one of my favorite podcasts. He's doing such incredible work. And I was so honored to have this conversation. So without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Brad Onishi.
Yep.
All right. Welcome to today's interview. We are here with Brad Onishi. And I've always called you Bradley. I think formally you're like Bradley everywhere. Do you get Brad or Bradley?
Usually Brad, but anything's fine. When your name's Brad, there's no good version of it. So you can just, you know, you can do whatever you want. Yeah.
Well, welcome. We have Brad here as well as my co-host, Megan Crozier.
Hey, hey.
Hello, Megan. How are you?
Good, good.
Cool. That's perfect. Megan came on as a host just here for second season. So we're just like working out like the flow. But so far we've got
like how to
feedback.
Say hello. That people maybe we should do that again. No, just kidding.
I think it adds you know, an aesthetic to the whole show. So yes. I like it. Cool. So, you know, we don't expect for anybody who we interview to have listened to anything else that we've put out. So I'll give you kind of the rundown. You know, we like to get a little background. You know, we're not Megan and I were talking about it the other day. We're not a unique show in any specific way. There's a lot of people that are having these conversations, but, you know, just around faith change. And while I have listened to / been a huge fan of yours through Straight White American Jesus for over a year now, I think. I don't know that I've really heard a ton of your story. Yeah. I mean, I know your byline and I you do incredible interviews, but maybe start by talking a little bit about what your origin was in faith. And then maybe how that drove you into the profession and, you know, kind of the work that you're doing.
Yeah. So, I grew up in Southern California and, my mom's a white woman from Tennessee, Missouri. Her family were part of the big migration west, in the 50s and 60s to California. And so she's a Southerner in in Southern California. My dad is a Japanese guy, Japanese American guy from Maui. And so he makes his way to California after high school. So they meet in the middle of Hawaii and Tennessee, get married, and grew up in a pretty non-religious household. Dad's sort of nominally Buddhist. Mom is nominally evangelical, but we never went to church. We never went to temple. We didn't do anything. By 14, they're divorced. When I'm 14, by that time, they've been divorced a couple years. I'm sort of heading into teenage angst in ways that would portend a career as a religion professor, like wondering what is the meaning of life? It all seems hopeless and meaningless. And as a result, sort of like exploring teenage drug, sex, and rock and roll, and kind of getting in trouble and, you know, suspended from school. And mom, can you drop us off at the movie theater? We're going to go see this show. And then we go behind the movie theater and we do teenage stuff and, you know, that kind of thing, right? So I get invited by my like eighth grade girlfriend to youth group at Rose Drive Friends Church on a Wednesday night. And I'm like,
classic story.
Genius. Like, you're 14 and you're like, you go to your mom after getting in trouble and doing all kinds of weird shit. And she's like, you know, yeah, you can go to church on Wednesday. Yeah, let's do it. I'll take you right now. When does it start? Like, what's, you know? And so my plan was meet my girlfriend, try to like sit through whatever, you know, Ned Flanders stuff we were going to hear, and then like go out into the field and make out, or like who's out there doing, you know, smoking or doing whatever they were doing. And so, you know, classic story, as you said, Cortland, show up, and instead of like Ned Flanders, all these youth leaders with tattoos and guitars, and they're playing video games, and some of them are skaters, and there's like Christian punk band playing in the background. And I'm like, whoa, so cool. And then I learn very quickly that Jesus will forgive all my sins, give me eternal life. And all of those like life is meaningless questions can get answered with like super shortcuts. And it's beautiful. And so girlfriend dumps me very soon thereafter. But now I'm off and running. I am, because she was not in it for Jesus. She was in it for youth group and like getting away from mom and dad. So as soon as I got in it for Jesus, she was like, all right, pal, that's enough.
This was not the plan.
Yeah. You're way into Jesus and not into me. And so just let's call it quits. And so at that point, I'm all in. Jesus freak on the way. Within 5 or 6 months, I go from the guy that's like behind the movie theater with friends being a juvenile delinquent to standing in front of the movie theater, asking people as they walk out if they know where their eternal salvation will be. By the time I got to high school that summer, or you know, that fall, I was helping to lead Bible studies, see you at the poll, yep. So I was super extra, right? I ruin everything by doing it way too hard. I ruin everything. Like anyone in my life will tell you, I ruin everything because I go way too hard. And that includes faith. And so they did see you at the poll once a year. And I was like, once a year, we're doing that every Friday. So I would go every Friday, and usually by myself, but sometimes there's like one or two kids with me, and I would just stand there and pray. And people would be like, why were you praying to the flagpole? And I'd be like, I wasn't, I was praying for our country and all this stuff. So, anyway, that's my story. Rapid change, Japanese American dad with a Buddhist background, not crazy about this change. But in the end, everybody was pretty happy about it, because instead of like getting in trouble and suspended and all that, I was up there with Jesus. And so it was kind of like, well, parents were like, yeah, you know, we'd rather that than the other. So, all right, go ahead. You know? So anyway, I'm happy to talk more about that, but that's the outline.
I'm curious. We have so much I want to talk about, but I'm curious, in your youth group culture, were you relatively unique as a kid who had kind of come from an unchurched background? And did that give you a sense of like, do you feel like leaders and people in the church kind of platformed you because of that?
Totally. Yes, exactly. Okay. So, gave my first sermon at 15, you know, was a kind of youth group darling because I had the radical, radical, maybe not, but I had a sort of transformational testimony.
Yeah.
And I went hard because I was a convert. So instead of being that kid who had grown up with it all, like all the songs were new, all the Bible was brand new. So I was going hard. I wanted to read the Bible all the time. I wanted to ask questions about what does this mean in Colossians 3 and Philippians 2. And so it definitely like put me forward as the golden child in the youth group. And so by the time I was a senior in high school, I was helping out with the younger kids in the youth group. And then by the day I graduated high school, I was hired at the church, at the mega church that I converted at. And so by the time I was 20, 2 years later, I was married and I was in charge of the youth group. I was in charge of the 200 kids in the youth group.
Wow.
And I was married and I was a full-time student at Azusa Pacific, which is a Christian college in LA. So, so that was all very healthy and balanced and, you know, just the real good situation for me at age 20.
I'm also a little bit curious. You said there was a little bit of contention with your dad. Did you, when you were going through all of that, did you feel like you had to try to save him and bring him in? And what was that like?
Hard at first and then totally successful. So he's an evangelical now and he's still there. So he eventually came around. He went with me on a missions trip to Mexico, which is a classic youth group thing in Southern California. Yeah. And he had a Jesus moment in his heart and he was off and running. And so he is now at the church that my youth pastor planted, a decade and a half ago. And so, you know, the contention's different now that I've deconstructed. It's he's worried about my faith and my everything
wild.
Else.
What a what a full circle story. So you got rushed into this, like you said, right out of high school, full-time ministry, you know, while you're also doing school. Did you say you got married at what age?
Yeah, so I met my first wife when I was 14, a freshman. She was this, we were sort of like matched. We were equally yoked, as they would say, in terms of our like zealousy and extremism. So we met, we dated. I mean, we had a couple breaks in high school, but essentially we dated all through high school. And then we married like 2 days after I finished the second year of college. Okay. And there was 1,000 people at the ceremony.
Good Lord.
Wow.
Because it was all the kids from youth group. And then like, you know, when you're the youth pastor and you're like nice to people's kids, they like you. And so all the parents came and the church staff came. And so it was like a whole deal. Yeah. It was a
wild.
Whole yeah.
Insane. That's crazy. I thought I had a big, like my wedding was too big, but it wasn't anything like that. That's wild. All right. So, you know, for sake of time, kind of maybe fast forward to what was it then moving from that, and we can always backtrack, that first, you know, kind of brought up questions for you and caused you to start rethinking, you know, this wild, zealous faith you adopted at 15, 14.
Yeah, you know, I feel like just as I got fast-tracked into it all, like I was able to fast-track out of it because of that, because I just, you know, I was just processing everything so quickly that by the time I was in college, you know, you start to take philosophy class, theology class, Bible class. And then you start to ask a few questions. And then by the time I'm a senior at APU, I'm really like diving into actual like church history and, you know, philosophy and theology. And I'm discovering things and I'm thinking, wow, there's all these other approaches that I've never heard of that are supposed to be out of bounds or at least kind of suspicious. And, the whole plan, of course, was for me to like become a senior pastor and just, you know, plant a church and all this stuff. We were married. We were the sort of golden children of our generation. And we realized quickly, like, we don't want to do that. And so I graduated and I went to seminary for 2 years, but I used seminary as like this excuse to just read everything, you know, read every bit of like theology and philosophy I could, church history. So by the time I did 2 years of that, we both recognize we need to get out of here. We don't fit anymore. You know, during that last year, I would pray in front of the youth group, 200 kids. And I would often wonder if I still believed in God while I was praying. And so, you know, I had that kind of experience. And so she was an athlete and I was wanting to, instead of do more seminary, I wanted to become a professor. I was like, oh, this is a safe thing to tell the church community. I'm going to be a theology professor. And if I can just get a job at a place like a Christian college, then I can read all the stuff I want and I won't have the scrutiny of being a pastor. And at least I can kind of pass for somebody still playing the game. So we start applying. We're like, you can play basketball in certain places in the world and I can try to go to grad school and they have to be English speaking places because we don't speak any other languages. So Australia, England, Scotland, New Zealand, those are the places. And, lo and behold, I applied to a bunch of places in the UK somehow. And if you want me to tell the story, I can. finagled Oxford University into letting me in to get a master's in theology. So went to Oxford. She came, played a season of semi-professional basketball there. And then we divorced to like 6 months later, completely amicably. Like, hey, it turns out when you're 14, you're different than when you're 24. And maybe we should be friends and still care about each other, but not be married. And it hurt like hell. And that was a whole nother deconstruction process, if you will. But yeah, anyway, so by that time I'm like at Oxford, I'm 6,000 miles from home. I'm completely free now to like explore every intellectual and social avenue I want. I'm no longer married. And now it's just like, I am completely untethered from any like loyalty to evangelical ways of thinking. And, you know, obviously the rest is kind of history in terms of just finding myself out of the movement.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan, do you have anything? I have plenty
no,
of things,
I, well,
but
I just,
you go ahead.
I think it's interesting because, and I don't know if it's really a question or just a comment, but I think there's a lot of people that have gone through or started their deconstruction during the pandemic. And you talking about being away and away from everything makes me kind of think that that might have simulated not a pandemic, but just a kind of an isolation that made you really lean into yourself and your own just thoughts about everything. What do you think about that?
I think that's so insightful. I think you're so right. Like I've talked to so many people who are like, you know, Brad, when the pandemic started, I was at church and there was a kind of rustling in my mind, but like with church being virtual and not having no one look at me and wondering if I'm actually there.
Yeah.
I did a lot of wandering and thinking and I'm deconstructing now, right? Like I've heard that from people so much. And you know, if I had just said, hey, I'm going to move an hour up the road and we're going to just kind of do life up here and I'm going to go like to Fuller Seminary, right? And which is an hour away from where I grew up, and I'm going to get my sort of PhD there. I think it would have been much more gradual and harder because those loyalties, those social ties would have still been in place. Like I'm 6,000, like I'd gone to Mexico and Canada. I had never been to Europe. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no place at Oxford University. And I have no partner. I have no friends. There's no one at church wondering what I'm doing with my life. When I leave the house, at the grocery store and everywhere else, instead of like meeting parents and 1,000 people that I know, for the first time in my adult life, it's like your whole job every day is to read books and to think about the most important things in life. And that, I mean, Megan, you're exactly right. It just rapid fired my process. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, just one more follow-up. Was there anybody that you were bouncing these ideas off with? Because I know a lot of people now are landing in these deconstruction communities and now people that kind of started that process a lot earlier are saying, hey, we didn't even have that word. We didn't even have that community. And so did you have people that you were connecting with and talking through any of these things with?
You know, I feel like my version of that was I had no deconstruction community. But I was studying, like I went to Oxford University to do a thesis on 20th century Trinitarian theology, right? Now I quickly changed that topic, but all of my intellectual interlocutors were a mix of like liberal Anglicans, right? From who were like queer affirming or social justice Methodists, right? And so all of a sudden I was around these different types of Christians who were like actually genuine people with real faith. And I was like, oh, I was told that you were not actual Christians and you did not have real faith. I guess that was right. And then I would meet gay Christians for the first time and be like, oh, huh. Okay. And so I had all of these like intellectual interlocutors. And then I was meeting socially all these folks that I would sort of describe as like this safe landing circle of like people of faith, people of no faith, people of different faiths that all sort of just convinced me like, oh, I hung out and with the liberal Anglican, the social justice Methodist, right, the gay Baptist, and I didn't die, and I didn't fall into nihilism, and my life still has meaning. And actually, those people are amazing and smart and sincere, and I actually really just want to hang out with them and learn from them, right? And so that was my sort of way of doing it. And it was confusing, and it was hard, because there was times I was like, yeah, I'm just going to be a social justice Methodist. And I would go to church with that friend and be like, nope, got to get out of here. You know, 8 minutes later, like, nah, got to go. Stomach doesn't feel good. See ya, Jeff. Sorry. You know, and then same with, you know, you go to liturgy, Anglican church, and there's incense everywhere and it's awesome and everyone's great, but I can't do it. I'm just like, no, I'm not supposed to be here either. Sorry, Janice. Thanks for inviting me. This incense has given me nausea. I got to leave. And so I just quickly learned I was not going to end up in church, right? Even if I was still thinking about religion and transcendence and all that stuff all the time. So
did you feel like at that point, because you're obviously still a person who cares a lot and thinks a lot about faith and religion and spirituality. And I'm curious, because you talk about this community, this academic community. I felt when I got out of ministry, like, and you know, quote unquote, moved into a secular, you know, social group, I felt really like outsidered, like, because I still wanted to talk about it. Do you feel like through academics you had enough avenues, or did you ever feel like, I don't know, fish out of water, like, you know, just like that you maybe didn't fit because you still were so passionate or wanting to read about faith, theology, and et cetera?
You know, it's funny because I went, when I was at Oxford, I was around all these people of various sort of mainly Christian backgrounds, but some, you know, and other traditions as well. And so I felt outsider there in the sense that I was realizing sort of rapidly, I don't want to go to church. I just don't want to do this anymore. Like, I'm interested in this intellectually, but I don't want to go to chapel before the fancy dinner at our college. I don't want to go to the Vesper service where we're singing the church songs near Christmas time. I just don't want to, right? So in that sense, I was times I kind of had to sort of scurry around those social dynamics. And then I do 2 years in England, and then I go to back home to California to UCSB, UC Santa Barbara, to do my PhD. And that's where I started to really feel that, what you're talking about, Cortland, where it was like, now I'm the guy who's actually still into religion. And all my friends are like, just Santa Barbara, you know, folks who are living their life. They're not religious. There's so many like hippies and spiritual, but not religious type folks in Santa Barbara that bringing in any of the like actual Christian or organized religion talk was sort of like, what, come on, bro. Like, what are you talking about? So that's kind of where that came up. And I had to kind of figure that part out, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You do a lot of work now with, you know, your academic work with Straight White American Jesus, talking about a lot of, you know, political dynamics, right? Like the political climate, how evangelicalism and faith has shaped, you know, radical alt-right politics, you know, has been a topic of the news lately that you've also been talking about. I'm kind of curious if you think that there is a connection between the political fear or the, I guess the, try not to like just put people in a box, that I would say that the right, or the, at least the conservative political environment I grew up in, feared education because like education would lead you into a bad life. And I feel like the youth group evangelical church I grew up also that fed me that message that's like, oh, we want you to go to college, but like, don't get too much education because you'll lose God. As a person who's a professor and has had a fair amount of education, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to many would be classified as someone who walked away from God. I guess, do you feel there's a parallel, and how do you address that fear in society and in church?
Yeah. So I was definitely told that, Cortland, just like you were. You know, if you read too much, you'll lose your faith. If you get too heady, then you'll lose your heart. And my, like I said before, I think my strategy was like, okay, if I can do the seminary route and become like a professor at a Christian college, that's an acceptable route. But even when I started sort of floating that, my elders in the church were like, yeah, that's good, but wouldn't it be better if you like planted a church over here or were a missionary over there? That would, you know, that seems like a lot more direct in terms of your impact. And so there was still this discouragement of like the reading and the thinking. And I remember I had this book on the atonement, you know, this really dense theological text. And I went next door to the guy who had the office next to me in the church. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm like 23 at this point. I'm like, hey, you know, you went to seminary, Greg. Do you think it's okay if I read this? It seems really interesting, but I don't want to read stuff that's going to like lead me astray or something. And he looked at me like, I don't know, because I would never read that. That's so boring. Why would you even want to read that book? Like that's, I don't know. I have no idea if it's going to lead you astray because I have no idea what it says. It seems ridiculous to me. And so there was this culture of like, not only don't do it, but why? Like, why do you want to go to a library and think about the Trinity? Why don't you go to Hawaii where your dad's from and plant a church, right? When I did deconstruct while I was at Oxford, you know, all of the rumors back at home were, yeah, Brad went into academia. He got super liberal. He got super, led astray by these liberal theologies and these godless whatevers. And look at him now, right? He is a big mess. I actually had somebody who I'd mentored, and they, during that process, were like, hey, I got into seminary at Azusa Pacific, right? Fuller Seminary. I also got accepted to do a doctor of ministry or an MDiv at Princeton and at Harvard. And they were like, which one should I do? And I was like, you should go to Princeton or Harvard, because it's going to give you all of this sort of wide, expansive view of things. And you know what? You can always go home. If you want to go home, back to the church, back to the same culture, back to the same place, you can. And I think because of my sort of whole journey, that person chose to stay home. Like they turned down the MDiv at Princeton and were like, I'm going to stay home because I don't want to end up like Brad, right? I don't want to end up thinking myself out of faith. And so I'm just going to stay put. So yeah, I definitely went from the golden child to the warning sign, right? Like, don't become that guy because everything will go bad, you know?
I think it's interesting that you had some really legit ways that you wanted to make a living, have a source of income, and everybody in your life was encouraging you, actually, no, instead of having this really solid plan, you should do things that are going to make your income rely on a lot of other people instead of just come from your work and your job. I don't know. I see that as pretty common in evangelicalism.
That's an interesting observation. I wouldn't have even thought about the fact that it like also keeps you restricted by your income being associated with quote unquote correct belief. It's interesting.
Well, I'm curious about both of you think of that in terms of like, you know, when we see folks who are deconstructing now, those who are coming out of ministry, I mean, you know, I think both of you have experience here is like, what skills do I have? What job am I going to get? Like, what profession do I, you know? And so my hypothesis has always been, how many 48-year-olds are there in America who are like, I don't believe half this stuff anymore, but I have a mortgage and I have three kids. And if I just go now, what am I have no idea how I feed my family. So forget it. I'll just stay put and kind of put my head down and we'll just keep moving. Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, I had nothing. I got brought into a cult-like church plant ministry when I was 17. Didn't get, you know, out fully until I was like 27. My resume was like, I can preach youth group sermons. I can make an illustration out of anything. I'm really good at making games that teenagers like. I mean, like, I had nothing to put on my resume, and I didn't think I could get a job. I mean, and I had a really fucked up situation where the leader of my organization would tell us, a lot of young kids that were involved in staff, and he would tell us you couldn't get a job at Wendy's, you know, if you wanted to. So like, yeah, you should stay here, you know. I mean, it was definitely very limiting.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of people like there's no, I still want to pastor. Like I don't believe in God anymore, but I still want to pastor, but there's no, I mean, there's, we have a friend, Ryan,
Ryan Mulkowski.
Yeah. Who's a chaplain. And I met with him a couple months ago and I was like, fuck man, can you make money doing that? Because that sounds like something I might, you can do that as an atheist. And he's like, yeah, you can do this as an atheist. So I was like, all right, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I'll just add, you know, we had another interview with Jill Lumen, and she talked about driving Uber, her and her husband driving Uber when they left ministry. And I think back, because when I got out of college, I had a youth ministry degree, and the church that I was working with at the time wanted me to be a full-time volunteer, and they wanted me to raise support or figure out a way they did not want to pay me. And I went back to school and got a teaching degree because I was like, I can't make a living like this. Like that's great. It was great in college when I was a student, but yeah. So definitely, I do have that same wonder at how. And I've gotten DMs from people that say, I'm in this situation and I'm trapped. I mean, I can't leave because I have a family. I have kids. I have, it's my income. So for sure.
No, I think your point, Megan, is exactly right in terms of like, you know, don't be a professor because we can't control you. We can't control you intellectually and we can't control you economically. And so, you know, you need to be a church planter or missionary and so on. I think that's a really astute observation for sure.
So when was it for you? I mean, you talked about going to Oxford and your thesis originally was on the Trinity. You said that shifted, that changed. And it feels like a lot of the focus of your study, at least, you know, recently, has been on this kind of dynamic of American evangelicalism and the intersection between that and, you know, the evangelical political force that's been existent in this country for, I mean, ever. When did that, you know, I guess, interest come up for you? And would you say that that's kind of the focus of your work, or is there more to your work that, you know, maybe I, you know, just haven't heard?
No. I think that's exactly right. So, you know, a lot of my work at Oxford and UCSB was what you'd call philosophy of religion. So it was really divorced from the kind of historical currents of evangelicalism or American politics. And for me, when I look back on that time, like 2007 to 2015, 16, it's really, to me, a process of like a processing period. Like, you know, just I didn't wade into these debates. I wasn't online looking to connect with other people deconstructing. I wasn't keeping up on what Jerry Falwell was doing or what you know, what's happening with Rush Dooney or Reconstructionists or Reform Theo Bros or any of that. I was in many ways just trying to process it all. If you fast forward, you know, you get to Trump's election and all of a sudden things ramp up. And, you know, even before that, I'd been teaching courses on the history of these things. But that's when, obviously, for a lot of us, the urgency ramped up. And so I met with my co-host, Dan Miller, and I was like, look, I think some folks are talking about this, but a lot of them are scholars doing this from the outside. Some of them are insiders who are telling their story, but they don't necessarily have the kind of historical background. You know, why don't we try to do something where we can combine, like, you were a Southern Baptist minister, I was a mega church person. Let's combine all of that, like, lived experience with the 20 years of academic training and just see if there's any way that our voice will help anyone. And, you know, we didn't know. And honestly, it just started as like, let's just give it a shot. And if it's our friends and colleagues who listen, cool, that's great. We never expected to have a big audience, but that's where we're at. And so for me, you know, my focus for the last 3 years has really 4 years has really just been intense study of the historical dynamics of Christian nationalism and the religious right in this country, as well as the sociological dynamics surrounding the identity of what it means to be an evangelical. What does it mean to be born again? What does it mean to be whatever in American culture? So I love doing the show because I get to talk to all of these scholars and journalists who have done this amazing work and learn from them and read their books. And it's an excuse for me to like learn everything I can about all this. So for me, it's like a really great job to have in terms of getting to learn and listen from really amazing people.
I'm curious. So before we recorded, I mentioned that I was listening to your interview with Kristen Coby DeMay. And so you had her on your podcast before she was really even a thing, before she had published Jesus and John Wayne. And I do think that her work was something that brought a little bit more awareness to some more people that otherwise don't lean into that part of evangelicalism and the history. And I'm wondering how the two of you maybe overlapped or intersected. And I mean, clearly you were aware of her work and knew what she was doing before a lot of us were. So I don't know if you could talk about that a little bit.
You know, we really just wanted, you know, Dan and I talked about it, and we really wanted to shine a light on the cultures of the ways that gender is enacted in evangelical spaces. And so we knew of Kristen's work before Jesus and John Wayne, and we thought, hey, we'll just reach out and see if Kristen wants to come on. And it was an amazing conversation. If you listen to that episode, it's from like 2.5 years ago, and you can see all of the wheels turning in her head. Like she's got it all there, the Jesus and John Wayne book. It's just not out yet. And yeah. I guess for me, it really exemplifies too, like, our show, it's like, you know, there's been times we've had people on the show who have a kind of bigger following or name, and it's awesome. And I don't get me wrong, I really enjoy that. I think my favorite thing though is like finding that person, journalist, scholar, activist, whoever, who's just got something to say that's really important, and just being like, hey, friends who are listening to this, I don't think you would have ever heard of this person unless we had brought them on. They wrote this great book, this great article. They have this great show, whatever. Listen to this. It's incredible. You know, and I think for me, that's like the best part of doing it. So Kristen was obviously one who was like that. And then Jesus and John Wayne comes out and now she's an international superstar, you know, probably as we speak, having lunch with like Ben Affleck and J-Lo and like, who knows, you know, who knows.
Most likely.
Up. Yeah.
Most likely. I'm curious. So you talked about, you know, the people at home talking about, oh, Brad, you know, Brad went to academia. He lost his faith. You know, probably some direct criticism of you that you experienced too. I'm curious whether the criticism has gotten maybe stronger, louder, or different since you've begun engaging with the political and cultural identities and not just the academic theologies.
You know, I was already really good at Straight White American Jesus has been really good for me because it's taken my energy away from things that are not helpful. So one of those things, like in 2008, for example, was me getting on Facebook and still having 1,000 friends from my old church on Facebook and just being able to poke the bear in every way possible. Like, I can speak evangelical better than you. I know the Bible better than you. You're not going to out-evangelical me. There's no way. I'm fluent. Like, you are still, like, you're in intermediate French. I am very confident that you want to go toe-to-toe here. You're going to lose. And so I would just get on and my wife would just be like, why are you doing this? Why? And I just had no other place to like direct my energy. What's the point? The point is from 2008 to 2015, there were so many threads on Facebook that were like 1,000, you know, comments long, but so many of those people silenced me after that because they just couldn't do it. Like, they would just get sort of to the point where they would like, you know, give up, or you're stupid anyways, or, you know, so you're going to hell, so I'll pray for you, right? Whatever it would be. My point is, since we started doing the show, so many of those folks have turned me off that it feels like that's less. The people that have come back are so many kids that used to be in my youth group who were like, hey, I deconstructed 5 years ago. I deconstructed 3 years ago. I found your show. You're like my youth pastor again. You're helping me like process this. And so reconnecting with them has been amazing. It's also helped me alleviate a lot of the guilt that I've had about being a youth pastor who used to teach the things that I taught. And so one of the unexpected blessings of the pandemic, I shouldn't even say, there I am talking Christianese.
It happens.
Dude, I do it all the time.
Edit this out. Never air this. I'm just kidding. One of the unexpected silver linings of the pandemic is like so many youth group kids reaching out and saying, hey, can we talk? You want a Zoom call? Because like, I've been listening to you for a year and I've been meaning to reach out. So that's been really cool, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I have another question, but Megan, do you have
something?
I just feel like I'm just like continuing. So this is partially personal experience. And so I'll try to keep as brief as I can. I feel like my parents, who are conservative, evangelical, Republican, Midwesterners, have gotten, and they may listen to the podcast. I've told them not to, but we'll see. I'll try to be as nice as I can. They've gotten crazier, like significantly over the last 4 years, over the last 6 years. And it's weird for me, even growing up where I wasn't allowed to watch Captain Planet as a child because it was liberal indoctrination about caring for the planet, right? That's pretty crazy. But like, to some extent, specifically around like gender, my parents have gotten extreme about these gender issues, right? And are just like, I mean, super transphobic and super homophobic. And I'm like, my parents got me an Easy Bake Oven when I was like six that was like pink and purple and there was like no stigma around it. And I was like, I want to cook and bake and I'm not into football. And I used to go over to my grandparents' house and I would like play dress up with my mom's old dresses, and me and my boy cousins would put makeup on each other. And my parents were like, oh, they're just playing. They're just kids. And it's okay. And now it's like, if I, you know, like paint my nails, my mom's like, do you want a sex change? And I'm like, I don't, but I almost want to get one just to like piss you off. Because you're so like so triggered, and it's like it feels like a cultural like pressure cooker that they've been in for the last few years. And I'm curious if you've seen that too with folks that you're interacting with or people that you're interacting with talking about maybe their parents or other people in their life who like, I'm like, how did you get so crazy so fast?
Yeah. You know, one of the, so I'm just finishing a book on this. And one of the ways that I really look at this is like a lot of white Christian nationalism in this country, both Catholic and evangelical, is and has been a response to the 1960s. So the 1960s, we have all these revolutions, right? We have the civil rights movement. We have queer liberation movements. We have Stonewall. We have women's liberation movements, right? The Feminine Mystique is published in 1963. Women enter the workforce en masse. We have the Loving Case, 1967, when like biracial couples can get married in every state with you know, legally and, you know, like, et cetera. If you trace the rhetoric of things like Focus on the Family or other prominent outlets, you'll see that they continue to like reference the 60s as like, that's when America lost its way. That's when this country went downhill, right? And so you see throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, fighting the culture wars, right? We got to fight back against, you know, like in 1992, Vice President Dan Quayle was like complaining that Murphy Brown, if anyone remembers Murphy Brown, this TV show, had a single mother who was a professional and had no desire for a husband, right? And Dan Quayle's out here talking about that, okay? And all, and Bill Clinton gets into a sex scandal. And of course, you know, he's persona non grata and blah, 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 right? The reason I bring all that up is if you get into the Obama presidency, right, all of those worst fears seem to come true. We have a black man as president. It's a biracial family. He has black children. His name is Hussein. His dad is an immigrant. His mom is a white woman who, you know, whose partners were not white. He spent time outside the country. So immigrant, person of color. And then all of a sudden, what happens? Obergefell and gay marriage is legalized, right? And at the federal level. And everything that they thought could happen, happened. And boom, okay, let's do it. Donald Trump is our barbarian king. He will knock down the walls and build the ones we need. He will tear down our enemies. And you know what? And I think there's so much good scholarship out there about this. This is not my original thought. Kristen Cobes Dumais talks about it. Leslie Doyle Smith talks about it. So many others. It's almost better that he's not Christian, because then he can be the barbarian who does all the unchristian things we really want to do, but feel like we can't. Like Mike Pence isn't going to cut it. He's too nice. He's too, you know, sort of like just kind of smug looking gray haired man rather than attack dog, right? Ted Cruz isn't going to do it. Mike Huckabee's not going to do it. We need Donald Trump, the barbarian. With that said, right, he ramps up the culture wars. And for the first time since the 60s, two things are true at the same time. The evangelicals and the white Christian nationalists have the guy in office they want, but they're still allowed to play the victim, right? So they're usually one or the other. It's usually we've got this communist Barack Obama in office and we got to take our country back. Or it's we got George W. Bush. Look who's in charge now, people. Look out. Christian country, here you come. Trump and everything that happened with MAGA Nation enabled two things to happen at the same time that were really powerful in radicalizing people that I think you're talking about, Cortland, which is we have all the power. We have both houses of Congress. We got the Supreme Court, and we're bulldozing over American democracy. And turn on Fox News tonight, and it's going to sound like we're the most persecuted, hated, minoritized people in the country. And they're both true at the same time. And look out, people, because your country's getting taken away from you as Donald Trump bulldozes everything and takes it back for you. And boom, we have your parents, we have your grandparents, we have all these folks that are now interested in not policy, not actually improving people's lives, but making sure the Potato Head is actually a man, or making sure we don't cancel Dr. Seuss, or we got to say Merry Christmas, or yeah, trans people trigger me, or, you know, blah, 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 you know what I mean? And all of a sudden it is ramped up to the point of like what has gone from a culture war, it's gone to a cold civil war in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, and it all makes sense when you say it, and it's like very well laid out there, but still when you have these interactions where like I post a tweet using words of Jesus and shifting between, you know, all pronouns. And like my parents see that as an act of violence towards them.
Yep.
Which is like you're saying, it's like, it is both the ability to hold a position of power and be victimized at the same time. And it's, I don't know exactly where I'm going with that other than I'm just fucking like so tired.
Oh, I was just going to say, I also think that it has an element of purity culture to it, not just sexual purity, but the whole idea of we want our what we read to be pure. We want what we listen to be pure. We want to make sure that we don't have anything tainting what we're, our music, our literature, everything else, the movies that we watch. And so I feel like that has also become more extreme in all of this. And so I don't know if that resonates or not, but.
I think, so one of the arguments I'm making in the book I'm writing is that Christian nationalism is the original purity culture. So purity culture says, be pure of body, you know, keep your mind pure of sexual thought, your body pure of sexual thought. And if you look at where it came from a concern about national security, right? It comes from the Cold War. And Sarah Mosliner's the best on this. She's an expert, but there's others, Melissa Wild, Christy Slominski. But it comes from, we're going to lose our country to godless communists. We're going to lose our country to godless hippies. We're going to lose our country to LGBTQ people. So you know what we need? Purity culture. But if you look at what's underneath purity culture, it's Christian nationalism. It's the country should be pure. The country should be a straight, white, American, native-born body. And it, right, pure of color, pure of queerness, pure of anything foreign, right? And so Christian nationalism, in my mind, is the original purity culture. And then we're off and running to everything I think you just said, Megan, and I think everything you said is exactly right. So,
yeah, I don't even know where to go, but that is, you're 100% correct. Can you talk maybe a little bit about more about the book that you're working on and, you know, kind of give people a teaser as to that? I think it's, you know, still a little ways out, but hopefully, you know, stir up some excitement about it.
Yeah, it'll come out January 6, 2023. And it's all about how, why Christian nationalism birthed MAGA Nation and how we got to January 6th. So definitely, go through a lot of the history I'm talking about today and sort of examine how Christian nationalism is really the integrating force of MAGA Nation and provides the way to integrate all of the racism, the xenophobia, the homophobia, all of the misogyny and the patriarchy. Christian nationalism isn't a weird add-on to that. It's a integrating mechanism. And so if you start with in the 60s, right, one way to see the Christian nationalist backlash of the last 50, 60 years is backlash against all of the ways that civil rights and representation were extended, right, to non straight white Christian men in the 1960s. Women, right, enter the workforce. Women can divorce their husbands and be economically independent, right? We have queer liberation movements. We have the civil rights movement. I can go on and on and on. One way to view Donald Trump is as the crescendo of a backlash against all of that. And then one way to view January 6th is simply a violent attempt to right the country when nothing else worked. And all of that was done through a Christian mantle or by way of a Christian mantle rather than against it or et cetera. And so, yeah, tracing the history of the religious right, Jerry Falwell and all that stuff, but also going into things that I think we often don't hear about, which is how evangelical leaders have been hanging out in Russia for 20 years. And like Paul Weyrich, the architect of the religious right, was praising Putin in 1999 and 2000, talking about conspiracy theories that not only QAnon, but QAnon is the grandson or grandchild or granddaughter of the Satanic Panic and the John Birch Society. Why Christian nationalists always turn to conspiracy theories when what they think is real and actual isn't backed up by everyone else. They're like, well, we have the privilege to just tell you what's real and actual. So here's our conspiracy theory to do it, right? So anyway, I can go on and on, but that's kind of the project. And it's all leading to January 6th and how that was a white Christian nationalist insurrection and how it was basically the beginning, not the end. January 6th, in my mind, was the first, not the last in a series of attacks on our democracy over the next couple of years.
Whew, that's going to be good.
It's a light read. Take it to the beach, you know, that kind of.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just back to a little bit of your personal journey. As somebody who's been an academic and loves to read, as you talked about, when you have been going through the process of deconstructing your faith, do you feel like, I know for a lot of people going through that, it's just so tough to live in the gray and kind of hold things loosely. Do you feel like you have read through and just studied and you've gotten to a point where you're like, okay, this is where I line up. This is what I stand for. These are my values, where you're really kind of, I guess maybe certainty isn't necessarily the word, but maybe like you're just really like, okay, I really do believe this, this, and that. I kind of throw out this, this, and that. And then at the end of the day, this is what I am. Or do you still struggle with that uncertainty and living in the gray?
I think if you don't struggle with uncertainty, then something's wrong, right? And so, but the second comment is, and this is where evangelicalism and a lot of religious traditions don't allow for this, is it doesn't mean uncertainty's bad, right? It doesn't mean you have to solve it. And so I think for me, one of the things that I told people close to me when I deconstructed was like, look, the way I was taught and the way you were taught is that religion is the kind of thing that when you go to bed at night, you want everything in your house put away in the drawer and in the space where it's supposed to be. You want to go to bed at night knowing that the laundry's put away and all the tools in the tool shed have been hung on the right rung, and there's no papers on the desk. And you go to bed and you're like, oh, good. It's all resolved. I can sleep now. And the opposite for me is true. This is what I would tell my friends and family members is like, I go to bed at night knowing that all of the things I worked on today will never be done. And I'm going to bed so excited to wake up tomorrow to think about all of the most amazing, complex, fundamental issues of being a human, even though I know that they are irreducibly complex and not the kinds of things that should be resolved. And so my excitement about being alive comes from the uncertainty and the irresolution. The human condition is not one you get to resolve. It's not there's no antidote to the human condition. That's how I feel. That the human condition is one that you have to learn to live with. It's not one you can take medicine for or solve or get yourself out of. And so if you accept that, right, that the human condition is one that I'll never escape, then you start to ask yourself, well, what does it mean to relish the human condition? So what it means is then, right, is that I have to accept that I'm mortal. And that brings with it two things. Overwhelming uncertainty and vulnerability. To be mortal is to be fragile. To be mortal is to be threatened. That's how it goes. But to be mortal, right, means that there's always something at stake, right? There's always something, right, that means something every moment of every day, that your life is this project of something, whatever you make it. And you have the ability, you have the privilege, you have the chance, right, to explore that to its fullest degree, to pursue yourself and your world in every way possible. And so with that chance, right, comes great responsibility and oftentimes great suffering. Being a human in the human condition hurts. It hurts. It hurts on a daily basis because I'm getting old and I get out of bed and my back hurts. It hurts in real tragic ways, like a pandemic where we've lost almost 1 million people, or you lose a friend in a way that is unexpected, or you see somebody go through suffering that is unwarranted. It's awful. And so if I still agree with anything, it is yes. Like, we are cursed, right? Like Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, we are cursed. It's true. To be a human is to live in many ways under a curse. It's hard and it feels like we have been put under a spell of suffering. All right, Genesis 3, you win. But here's where I disagree with the rest of the story is, right? It's not about escaping that curse in a way that negates the wonder of being that mortal human. Because my dog, the birds I see outside, they have no acute awareness of themselves or their world or their mortality. And so that space that's opened up when you have that acute awareness is that's the privilege of being human. And so, yes, it's often a curse, but it's often a wondrous journey that no one else gets to go on. And so every time as humans that we occupy that space, every time we dance, every time we write, every time we tell stories, every time we pass time with meaning, every time you hug somebody in a way that is full of love and care, every time you wake up next to someone, even if it's not forever, that you have in some way shared something wondrous with. Every time you sit at a table, instead of just stuffing your mouth with food, you actually break bread and you recognize what it took to bring that food to yourself and your community and to sit there and share it with another human being and to listen to their story. That is the way we overcome the curse. You can sit and be sedimented by the like overwhelming suffering of what it means to be in this fucking awful condition of being human. Or, right, you can occupy that space and say, I'm not going to let the curse overwhelm the wonder. And that's the goal. That's always the goal. Whether you're an atheist, an agnostic, a person of faith, I don't care. To me, that's where I come from in terms of being a human being. And so, you know, waking up every day is exciting. Waking up every day is an adventure. Waking up every day is something new at stake rather than a closed book and just waiting for the end to come, which is kind of the way I was taught. So that was a lot. That was a lot of, I apologize.
Beautiful.
I sort of lost contact.
Amen. Like Megan's going to like close us out in music now. We're going to pass the plate for Brad. I'm just fucking kidding. That was really, really well said. Really good. And I can relate a lot to that.
Yeah, no. And y'all had this experience. You're teaching Sunday school and some kid's like, what are we going to do in heaven? It seems like it's going to be boring, you know? And you're like, no, we're going to, all right, 7 minutes left till we're over. No, it's going to be fine. Like we're going to worship God. It's going to be super fun. Parents will be there. Maybe at least your mom. We all know your dad's not a good dude, but your mom will be there. It'll be good. It'll be fun. And like kids still like, it seems boring. And why? Because, right? Eternal life in that way is rendered as dying. Nothing's at stake. There's nothing tomorrow where anything matters. Everything is a perfect standstill. It has all come to a sense of inertia, right? To a sense of just absolute rest. So you can say, well, that's perfect because then there's no more vulnerability. But you can also say that's the worst because it's like dying, right?
Yeah.
Like there's this episode in the Odyssey where like Odysseus goes to meet with Calypso, the goddess, and he's lost. He's trying to get home. You know, he's on the Odyssey and like he's on Calypso's island. Who's Calypso? Beautiful goddess. Where's Calypso live? Paradise. There's like fruit hanging off her walls, all kinds of amazing food. Every night they go into like her warm cave. They have dinner. They sleep together. And then there's the beach. It's like, wow, this is like a beer commercial. And she's like, hey, I'm a goddess. I'm going to make you eternal and we'll just do this forever. Right. And what does Odysseus do? He goes to the shore and he cries his eyes out every day because all he wants to do is go back home into time, into temporality, and like be with his family and create and make and occupy the space of what it means to be, right, a temporal human being. The idea of that inertia on that island sounded to him like dying rather than sounding like heaven. And, you know, I guess that's kind of where I'm at these days.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the evangelical idea of heaven I was handed sounds a lot more like hell these days, for sure, like to me.
Yeah.
It reminds me of The Good Place. Like, wait a second.
Yeah. Exactly. Sure. Exactly. Well, we could talk to you for several hours. Yeah. Obviously, there are hours and hours of great content from you that people can turn this off and flip on over at Streetwide American Jesus, as well as if you go to your website, there are those series that you've done, correct? So those are great. What was the one that you did had orange?
Yeah, the orange wave. The orange wave.
Was incredible.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
I just want to encourage people to go and listen to it and pace yourself because I binged it. And then I was like in kind of a existential crisis for a minute afterwards.
Oh, no.
In a good way. I came out of it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like we needed that. Right. I needed that. But yeah, pace yourself. But it is important for us to be aware of all of the stuff that's going on. You said it in one of your latest episodes I was just listening to, is that if people are paying attention, they should be a little unnerved of some of the things that are going on. And it's important, for sure. So thank you so much. Megan, did you have anything else before we close out?
No. Is there anything else, Brad, that you want to add about where people can find you and engage with your work?
Yes.
Yeah. You can find, the show at Straight White JC on Instagram and Twitter. You can find me at Bradley Onishi. And yeah, we're at straightwhiteamericanjesus.com. You can find us there, and that's the best place. And the book will be out in about a year. So, look out for that, in a year. So yeah, that's about it. Thank you. Let me just say, you know, thank you all for inviting me and for having me, and, just appreciate everything y'all are doing. And, you know, the guests you've had on are just amazing. So it's really humbling to be kind of just part of, that lineup. So, you know, thanks y'all, and just keep up the good work.
Thanks.
We appreciate that. Absolutely. Thank you.
Wow. That was a great interview.
See, it's always, we just a smooth glide into the closing. I want to just quickly bring up that we've had a couple more people leave us reviews on Apple Podcasts, which is super, super helpful. Every week when we put out episodes, we always ask if you are enjoying the show, if you would take 2 minutes. It's like asking for reviews. Everyone does it. It's so constant. And I know it always feels like a lot, but it is pretty quick. If you like the show and you have Apple Podcasts, go and just jump over there and leave a star rating and a quick review. It's really helpful for us. Of course, we always want people to subscribe on whatever platforms you regularly listen. As well as now we have the ability to do a rating on Spotify. So Spotify is starting to do their own charts and ratings, just like Apple Podcasts. And so if, like me, you're a Spotify podcast listener, you can give us a star rating over on Spotify as well. Megan, would you tell everyone where they can connect with us?
Yeah, give us a shout out on social media. We love seeing what people's thoughts are. And sometimes people will be listening and tag us while they listen. And we love it. It's always fun to see what people think. And generally, are the guests that we're interviewing get involved too in that conversation. And so that's been fun too. So you can follow us on Instagram at thereafterpodcast, on Twitter at thereafterpod, and you can always look for Cortland at Cortland Coffee on both, or find me at The Pursuing Life. And yeah, I think that does it. Check out Bradley Onishi. We'll put his information in the show notes too, but his podcast is awesome. And Straight White American Jesus.
Yeah, go listen to podcast episodes that they have out, as well as their series. If you go to their website, they have all their series. They do some really in-depth podcast series, as well as they have a Patreon and all kinds of things that you can get involved with. I think they just launched a course, tons of stuff. So we'll put as much as we can in the show notes, as always. If you hear us say we'll put something in the show notes and it's not in the show notes, complain to us on Twitter and we will get you some kind of prize.
Just, yeah, bring us your receipts and you'll get a free cookie next time.
All right, we'll see you all next week. Thanks for tuning in to this week of Thereafter.
Until next time.